From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Happy New Year. 1997 is over, and our Critics' 10 Best lists are completed on this New Year's Day edition of Fresh Air. Our rock critic Ken Tucker plays selections from his picks for the 10 best CDs of 1997. And our film critic John Powers runs down his list and talks about some of the issues and trends that emerged in the film world in 97. The best movies and pop music of 1997 coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. A witness to the skiing accident that took the life of Michael Kennedy says Kennedy was playing with a makeshift football and using a video camera when he crashed head-on into a tree at a resort in Aspen, Colorado. President Clinton and Vice President Gore have spoken to members of the Kennedy family to express their condolences. More from NPR's John Biewen.
Witnesses say the 39-year-old Kennedy crashed into a tree while skiing with several family members, including his mother, Ethel. He was pronounced dead an hour and a half later at an Aspen area hospital. Michael Kennedy was once considered the next political star in the Kennedy family, until it was reported last spring that he'd had an affair with the family's 14-year-old babysitter. Kennedy underwent treatment for alcoholism last year, and after a separation, he and his wife of 16 years had reportedly reconciled in recent months. The couple have three children. Michael is the second of Robert and Ethel Kennedy's 11 children to die young. His brother David died of a drug overdose in 1984. John Biewen, NPR News.
A key member of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government is resigning. Foreign Minister David Levy says he will vote against Netanyahu's proposed 1998 budget, calling it an evil policy that does not address the growing problem of Israel's needy. Levy says he'll step down after voting against the budget. A meteorologist for Steve Fawcett says the adventurer is doing well so far in his bid to become the first person to fly a balloon around the world nonstop. Fawcett set out yesterday from St. Louis. He's now over the Atlantic, headed for Europe. Hundreds of new laws go into effect today in states all over the country. NPR's Adam Hochberg has more.
By far, California leads the nation in the number of new laws that become effective January 1st. More than 700 measures take effect in California, including a ban on smoking at bars, a requirement that minors get their parents' permission before having their bodies pierced, and a law that forbids cloning a human being. Elsewhere, several states have tightened their drunk driving laws, and Minnesota has made it a crime to drive a snowmobile drunk. Hawaii lowers automobile insurance rates, while New York requires health insurance policies to cover breast reconstruction surgery for women who undergo mastectomies. Rhode Island and California take steps toward deregulating electric companies and allowing them to compete against each other. And New York motorists who accidentally run over cats now are required to notify the police or the animal's owner. Adam Hochberg, NPR News.
A New Year's tradition that's more than 100 years old is underway in Pasadena, California, the Rose Parade. Some spectators have been camped out since Tuesday to get prime viewing spots. It was a noisy New Year's Eve for the first family. The White House says the Clintons took part in a tradition from the First Lady's childhood and banged pots and pans at the stroke of midnight. The President and Mrs. Clinton are taking part in the annual Renaissance weekend retreat at Hilton Head, South Carolina. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, Bank America has announced that it could face a $5 billion judgment stemming from a 1994 antitrust lawsuit. The suit alleges that the brokerage house of Robertson Stephens, which was acquired by Bank America this fall, colluded with other brokerage firms to rig stock prices on the NASDAQ exchange. From member station KQED in San Francisco, Jason Beaubien reports.
Last week, 30 brokerage firms agreed to a landmark $1 billion settlement of the class action lawsuit. Bank America remains the lone holdout in the case. The suit alleges that between 1989 and 1994, 37 brokerage companies, including San Francisco-based Robertson Stephens, artificially inflated the spread between the buy and sell price of stocks on the NASDAQ exchange. Bank America acquired Robertson Stephens this October. Under federal antitrust law, Bank America could be held liable for the actions of all 37 of the firms accused of impropriety. An attorney for Bank America confirms that if a jury rules against the company, the damages could be as much as $5 billion. But Bank America officials continue to state that their subsidiary did nothing wrong. For NPR News, I'm Jason Beaubien in San Francisco.
A federal judge has rejected as unconstitutional parts of a landmark law that restricts the regional Bell phone companies from providing long-distance service. The decision came in a lawsuit filed in Texas by SBC Communications. Federal Judge Joseph Kendall ruled that the Telecommunications Act of 1996 discriminated against the five so-called baby bells. An SBC spokesman called the ruling one of the greatest so far for consumers as far as telecommunications law, but the FCC chairman, William Kennard, expressed disappointment over the ruling. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, putting a world of knowledge within your reach with over 200 locations across America. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Happy New Year. We're doing our annual 10 Best Show today with our film critic John Powers, who will join us later, and our pop music critic Ken Tucker. Ken has not only brought his list of the best pop, rock, and hip-hop records of 1997, he's brought some of the CDs on the list so he can play them for us. In fact, let's get started with a track from his pick for the best record of the year, Bob Dylan's Time Out of Mind. This is Till I Fell in Love with You.
Well, my nerves are exploding, and my body's tense. I feel like the whole world got me pinned up against the bed. I've been hit too hard, I've seen too much. Nothing can heal me now, but your touch. I just don't know what I'm gonna do. I was alright till I fell in love with you.
And Tucker, why is Bob Dylan's record your favorite record of the year?
Well, it's just an amazing piece of music making, I think, produced by Daniel Lanois in this sort of dreamy, beautiful style that really brings out both the cragginess of Dylan's voice and the beauty of his words. You know, it's I'd never heard an album from him that's quite as prickly and generous and funny and so completely free of irony. It really stood out in this year for that reason. I mean, Dylan this year, I mean, it's quite a year. He's, you know, survived heart disease, a meeting with the Pope, and receiving a Kennedy Center honor from Charlton Heston. I think this is the very definition of a survivor. his own son, Jacob Dylan, had a huge pop success with his band, The Wallflowers. And yet here's Dylan putting out this record that culminates with this 15-16 minute cut called Highlands, which I think is one of the most extraordinary things he's done. I mean, the whole album is about death, a kind of longing for death, a kind of talking about love as if love is something that he's experienced and may never attain again. I mean, it's a beautifully kind of reverential record about a kind of man's reveries looking back on his past.
What do you think of his voice now, his frayed voice?
I love his voice. I mean, there's a lot of criticism. I mean, he helped produce a Jimmy Rogers tribute album, and people were talking about this squawking croak he had on that. I think his voice is wonderfully expressive on this. It's very, very conversational, very direct.
What are some of the other groups that made or tried to make comebacks in 97?
Well, there are a lot of these old geezers around this year. I mean, the Rolling Stones tried to launch a tour. The tour was successful. Bridges to Babylon, the album, I think, was a pretty mixed success, actually a fairly mediocre release from them. John Fogerty came back with a new album after a decade, Blue Moon Swamp. Fleetwood Mac did a very respectable comeback job putting out this album of greatest hits and a couple of new cuts called The Dance. Paul Simon is in the process of trying to make a comeback with this production of The Cape Man on Broadway that he's written with the poet Derek Walcott. Elton John certainly came to the forefront of people's minds again when he performed Candle in the Wind at Princess Diana's funeral. Elton John gave an interview in Rolling Stone this year with Edmund White that I just admired more than any other rock star interview I'd read in a long time, because he came across as this tough old bird. Like, you know, you don't like me, too bad. It was an address to kind of the younger generation. I'm going to keep going. I'm going to keep making hits. This is my life, and I really like to do what I do. And I thought it was inspiring in some ways. I thought the best of that kind of older generation of rockers showed that you keep going. It doesn't matter that rock and roll is not a music of youth.
Well, the bands making comebacks aren't necessarily appealing to the young people, but one of the bands on your top 10 list is incredibly young.
Yes.
And quite a success story.
Yes, Hanson, this trio of young fellas from, young fellas, he said, old fogish, these young whippersnappers from Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hanson, these brothers were, 17, 14, and 11. What I really liked about these guys is they have a real appreciation not just for white rock and roll, but old 60s soul music. They're kind of mature beyond their years. They put out an album, their debut, called Middle of Nowhere. It's really good. I think we should play a cut from that.
What do you want to hear?
Sure. It's a song called Where's the Love?
I think a lot of Hanson's listeners are preteens.
Yeah, I think so.
So what are you hearing it, Ken, as an adult?
Oh, well, to me, I mean, there's a whole context in terms of that kind of teeny bopper rock I mean, that sort of genre has tossed up a lot of great hits over the years. Everything from, you know, the Archies to the Monkees to there's just a lot of energy in that music. And I think a well-constructed pop single like that has a kind of bursting energy that can get to anyone at any age.
A lot of the really young bands that have come out over the years have had incredible producers behind them, helping to provide the overall vision. Mm-hmm. Does Hanson have that?
Well, a couple of the cuts on that album were produced by the Dust Brothers, who were kind of a fashionable hip-hop production team. But the rest were done by themselves, and really, of all this kind of teen groups, they are the least controlled by a producer. That would be the opposite of something like the Spice Girls, who also hit big this year. The Spice Girls, you know, I found very charming in the fact that they were completely manufactured and tried to kind of give out with this sort of proto-feminist girl power rants in the midst of their pop singles that they put out. And their biggest hit, Wannabe, I thought was a very catchy song. By the time this year had ended, they put out their second album called Spice World, which was a complete flop. I mean, they've done the complete cycle in 1 year, from number one to a complete bomb. I think the real kind of girl power that the Spice Girls were talking about can be heard in the music of Sleater-Kinney, this female trio from Olympia, Washington, that last year I put their album Call the Doctor on my 10 best list, and this year their album that they released this year called Dig Me Out, I also loved. I mean, Sleater-Kinney kind of continues that punk rock tradition of lots of simple guitars, yelled lyrics. Corinne Tucker's voice, I think, is just an extraordinary instrument. It's like this kind of joyous screech. It's like this voice that's inflamed with the exhilaration that comes from just the sheer pain of love. I mean, there's a lot of sort of agonized love songs on this album, and I'd like to play one of them called Words and Guitar.
Words and guitar, I got it, words and
the noise. That's Leader Kenny, one of the records on Ken Tucker's Top 10 of 1997. I think, Ken, this would be a good place to take a short break. Then we'll talk some more and listen to more music from your Top 10.
Sounds good.
This is Fresh Air. My guest is Fresh Air rock critic Ken Tucker, and he's playing for some of the records on his top 10 list of 1997. What happened in rap and hip-hop in 97?
Well, I would say that the defining event in hip-hop this year was the death of Biggie Smalls, or to use his real name, Christopher Wallace. Was 24 years old, murdered in a drive-by shooting in L.A. that still hasn't been solved. As the notorious Big, he had put out an album called, presciently enough, Life After Death, which also used as a collaborator producer Sean Puffy Combs. These two really defined that kind of last gasp of gangster rap, that kind of hardcore hip hop. Over the course of the year, Puffy Combs, who had a tremendous success with his song "I'll Be Missing You," which was a kind of salute, goodbye, farewell to Notorious Big. That was a huge hit. To me, a lot of that music has exhausted whatever creativity it had within it. And so I was cheered by the emergence of a woman like Missy Elliott, who's only 25 years old. She's a songwriter and producer as well as a performer. She put out her debut album called Supa Dupa Fly, which had a wonderful cover of the old 70s Ann Peebles hit, I Can't Stand the Rain. That became the big hit. But she works, she produces her records along with a guy named Tim Mosley, and I think together they're going to be the production team for the next few years, that kind of style that they have, which is to kind of bury the words under lots of very thick collage kind of soundscapes. A lot of times the music is nearly abstract. A lot of times the words are almost nonsense syllables, as in the cut that I'd like to play, which is called Izzy Izzy Ah.
Girls be talking like they all rah-rah. Blizzy, blizzy, blase, blase, blase. None of y'all ain't that good to get with me. Izzy, izzy, ah, zah, zah, zah. Girls be talking like they all rah-rah. Blizzy, blizzy, blase, blase, blase. None of y'all ain't that good to get with me. M-A to the G, double O. My man Mo, smooth like Joe. Timberland, where you get that dough? I'ma get my people, people, come and drink some more. Flow to me comes so natural. I'ma take a stroll, roll this hydro. I'ma take my ass to pizzazz or esso.
That's Missy Elliott, and her CD is on Ken Tucker's Top 10 for 1997. Ken, who's next on your Top 10?
Corner Shop, this British West Indian band led by songwriter-singer Jinder Singh. To me, Corner Shop really occupied the place that Beck did last year on my list, in the sense of someone completely out of left field doing something that no one else is doing, this kind of cut-and-paste collage using a whole array of influences. Corner Shop's debut album was called When I Was Born for the Seventh Time. I really like the way that Jinder Singh combines this kind of singer-songwriter, confessional lyrics often, combined with this Punjabi rhythms, hip-hop rhythms. It's a real eclectic sort of record that I think really hit a lot of people very hard as a kind of influence this year. The track I'd like to play is called Sleep on the Left Side.
Call. We're gonna take it, that virgin fall.
really catchy, and I guess one of the things that intrigues me about the record is that it has the influence of everybody's interest in world music now, but it's so translated into pop.
That's right, yeah.
Plus English lyrics.
That's right.
Which I like.
Exactly.
Well, Ken, so far on your 10 best list, we've heard from Dylan Hansen, Sleater-Kinney, Missy Elliott, and Corner Shop. Why don't you run down the rest of the groups that made it onto your 10 best?
Yeah, there are two country albums on my list. Certainly of the major country releases by big stars this year, Shania Twain's album, which is called Come On Over, I liked a lot. I liked it in the sense of it being an album that really wants a big, large, wide audience, but yet remains true to its vision of a kind of country pop. I didn't care as much for the other big releases like Garth Brooks' Sevens and Leanne Rimes' You Light Up My Life, which I thought were kind of overblown and pretentious kind of releases. The smaller country album is by a guy named Buddy Miller, who lives in Nashville primarily as a songwriter, but he's originally from New York. He put out an album called Poison Love on a small label High Tone that I really liked a lot in terms of its being a very traditional, old-fashioned country music album. There are two singer-songwriter albums on my list. Ron Sexsmith, a singer-songwriter from Canada, put out an album called Other Songs that had a lot of lovely music on it. And Michael Penn, whom you interviewed here recently, his album Resigned, I thought was a really terrific example of that kind of very richly produced pop music that that I really appreciate. The final album on my list is by Yo La Tengo, the New York band, their album called I Can Hear the Heart Beating His One. Ira Kaplan and Georgia Hubley, the husband and wife team who write and perform most of their music, I thought they did a really great job 10 years on, carrying on that kind of post-punk tradition in Lower Manhattan.
Ken, what do you think were some of the defining moments of 1997 in pop?
Well, if you read the rock press and listened to the hype, this was supposed to be the year of electronica, of jungle music, of drum and bass music, which all came from England. And it didn't really take off here at all. I mean, the English have much more of a taste for that kind of novelty, whereas I think this year in America it proved to be very much a middle-of-the-road pop year. Tremendous success for acts like Celine Dion, Jewel, just completely forgettable acts to my ears, like Matchbox 20, a British group called Jamiroquai that won a lot of awards. I think one of the things you saw this year was that rise of the female singer-songwriter, particularly this summer, the Lilith Fair that was organized by Sarah McLachlan, and in the success of people like Sean Colvin and Jewel. I must say, you know, I took my 15-year-old daughter to see Sarah McLachlan, and I sat there saying, this isn't even Linda Ronstadt. This is like, I don't know, Maria Muldaur or Carla Bonoff, some very minor 70s singer-songwriter kind of influence. I can understand the impulse to enjoy that music, but it seems to me to be a very generational phenomenon. There was a lot better music around that I thought was being made kind of in the margins by sort of more sort of stubborn individuals who kind of prize song form, a very conservative kind of American songcraft. I think that's what Bob Dylan was about. In a way, that's what Hanson is about. It can go from age to youth in that sense.
You've also brought with you some ideas of rock and roll moments that embodied rock and roll, even though they weren't really musical moments.
Yeah, it struck me that there are a lot of kind of non-rock figures who embodied the spirit of rock and roll, mm-hmm. as well as anything in the music. I'm thinking of things like Chris Rock, the way he hosted the MTV Video Awards and really punctured a lot of pretensions, in particular the way he sort of savaged Fiona Apple's rather adolescent rant about what's hip and what's not in rock music. There's a moment in the movie Boogie Nights when Mark Wahlberg is getting dressed and you suddenly up on the soundtrack swells Casey and the Sunshine Band's Boogie Shoes. It just gave me the shivers. It just was like a great, it was just wonderful to have that song set off that way. I thought that was a great rock and roll moment. Greil Marcus's book called Invisible Republic, which was a kind of cultural history of the making of Bob Dylan and the band's basement tapes, I thought that was a rock and roll moment through literature this year that was wonderful. Ellen DeGeneres, the way she came out on her show, to me that was the sort of TV equivalent of Sleater-Kinney. You know, a real kind of aggressive, I am a lesbian, this is me, deal with me, which I found echoes in the Sleater-Kinney record. I thought that that was an interesting moment. And the death of Allen Ginsberg in April really brought home to me how much Ginsberg was that kind of spirit who embodied rock and roll, too. I mean, he literally collaborated with rock acts over the years, including The Clash. And on this Corner Shop album that is on my list, Corner Shop set a poem of his to music. And he himself released a recording this year called Ballad of the Skeletons that I think would be appropriate to end with.
Well, why don't we do that? And Ken, I want to thank you for talking about 1997 in pop. Ken Tucker is Fresh Air's rock critic and also is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. And Ken, I want to wish you a happy 1998.
Well, same to you, Terry. Thanks a lot.
Thanks. And here's Allen Ginsberg. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Said the presidential skeleton, I won't sign the bill. Said the speaker skeleton, yes, you will. Said the representative skeleton, I object. Said the Supreme Court skeleton, what do you expect? Said the military skeleton, buy star bombs. Said the upper class skeleton, starve unmarried moms. Said the Yahoo skeleton, stop dirty art. Said the right wing skeleton, forget about your heart. Said the Gnostic skeleton, the human form's divine. Said the Christian coalition skeleton, no, it's not, it's mine. Said the Buddha skeleton, compassion is wealth. Said the corporate skeleton, it's bad for your health. Said the old Christ skeleton, care for the poor. Said the Son of God skeleton, AIDS needs cure. Said the homophobe skeleton, gay folks suck. Said the heritage policy skeleton, blacks are out of luck.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Fresh Air film critic John Powers runs down his top 10 list and talks about the issues and trends that emerged in 97. This is Fresh Air. I'm Tariq Gross. We're doing our annual 10 Best show today. Our film critic John Powers has brought his list of the 10 best movies of the year, and he has some thoughts on the larger film issues and trends that emerged in 1997. But let's start with his top 10.
Before I actually give the list, I mean, I want to explain a little bit, because people often ask how we come up with these lists when we're critics. And the answer is you don't have a clue how you come up with them. You know, there are like four or five movies that you really, really know are on the list. And then there are all these others you're not sure about. And then every year I try a different strategy. You know, some years I sort of like try to like, you know, pretend I'm on Mount Olympus deciding what history will think are the best movies of the year. This year, I'm following a strategy that was, I guess, articulated by the late rock critic Lester Bangs, who used to claim that the 10 best records of the year were not the 10 that were actually the best, but the 10 you put on your stereo the most. And my 10 best list this year are the 10 movies that I have either seen more than once with pleasure, but who would also like to go back and see. It's like there are certain films, for instance, you know, Martin Scorsese's Kundun, or Victor Nunez's Uli's Gold, which I thought were really, really good films. But at the same time, I'm not in a great hurry to go back and see them. Whereas the 10 on this list, I've gone back to see them or will go back. And the 10 films are L.A. Confidential, Boogie Nights, The Day Trippers, a little comedy by Greg Mottola, Chasing Amy, the romantic, weird love story about a comic strip artist and a lesbian, a Hong Kong film called Comrades Almost a Love Story, which is by a man by the name of Peter Chan, which won all the awards in Hong Kong this year, which is basically the love story of two people from the Chinese mainland who meet in Hong Kong, and over a period of years how they fall in love. It's the kind of movie that maybe might have starred Albert Finney and Audrey Hepburn in the old days, but it's now being made in Hong Kong rather than the United States. There's a French film called A Self-Made Hero, which is about a guy who pretends to have been a resistance hero and how he rises, which is an extremely good film. My Sex Life, or How I Got Into an Argument, which is another French film, which is basically about a three-hour story of this group of people's sexual relationships where they're constantly sort of shifting partners and talking about it, which is extremely good. A little Palestinian film called Chronicle of a Disappearance, which I think is the only Palestinian film I've ever seen that is incredibly light and deft in its touch and manages to make all sorts of big political points without ever getting heavy-handed in any way. At the exact opposite end of the extreme is a film called Underground, which is this big, huge, brawling film made by Imir Kusturica, which is an allegory about the former Yugoslavia. And it's actually a dazzling piece of filmmaking, you know, sort of comparable to maybe Fellini at his best. It's just an overwhelming vision of this demented society. And then finally, my 10th movie is Quentin Tarantino's Jackie Brown, which I think is a supremely funny movie, one of the best movies of the year. But also I want to make the point that because of the weird expectations in the world, this movie is considered to be a disappointment by lots of people, but if somebody other than Quentin Tarantino had made it, it would probably make his or her reputation.
John, the way you read the list, L.A. Confidential was number one. Is that your best movie of the year?
Yeah, I think L.A. Confidential is the best movie of the year. In terms of, you know, overall acting, theme, and all the rest, it's the best film. Yet, strangely enough, you know, I have real passions for some others as well. I mean, I think what I love about Boogie Nights is the kind of feeling and mood of the film. It's the movie this year where I think I could enter at any point. If you just put it on video, say, for me, I would immediately like what I was seeing and would just want to keep watching. And that's not true of L.A. Confidential, which is so heavily structured and so well plotted that if you come in half the way through, you're not enticed in the same way. And then there are a couple small American movies, The Day Trippers and Chasing Amy, that I just kind of have a crush on. I love the good writing. I love the spirit of them. You know, Chasing Amy is a very passionate love story, and The Day Trippers is a very warm and perceptive family comedy. And I like the fact they were made really cheaply by people who had a lot of invention. And actually, I feel incredibly warmly disposed toward those movies in a kind of way that I could never feel towards, say, a film like Titanic or Amistad.
John, I noticed 5 of the 10 films in your 10 best list are foreign. What does that say about the strength of the American film industry and foreign film industries?
Well, actually, I think what's funny is that it's that really, if I were being honest about what were the best films, it's possible more than five would be foreign. But you know, I was trying to make sure that I would be giving a list that our listeners might have had some chance to actually connect to. In particular, I had a difficult time, you know, whittling down the list of French films to two. I have here A Self-Made Hero and a thing called My Sex Life. But this year there have been a bunch of others: Nanette et Bonny, Irma Vep, a nice little film that's out right now called Will It Snow for Christmas. There's When the Cat's Away, and a bunch of others that I've seen. And I would say virtually all of them are better than virtually every American movie. There are probably 10 American movies that could stand up to the French films that are out right now. It's a kind of sea change, because a while back French cinema wasn't doing very well, and the films were really boring and not very interesting.
They were all cute or historical.
They're all cute or historical, but what has happened is there's a sort of new generation of filmmakers that has emerged, and they are now so much better than the young American generation that it's not even funny. Like, you know, I mean, when if you go to film festivals as I do and you see the things side by side, your heart sinks that you're supposed. I was on the jury last year at Sundance, and honestly, out of the 16 films in competition, there were probably three films that were good. You know, the other 13, you know, got a lot of press because it's Sundance and it's American independence. But in fact, I think every French film I've seen this year is better than those 13 films.
Is there a certain American malaise you see now?
Yes. Well, I think what's happened is that there's the boom idea where suddenly anybody could make a movie. And what you realize is that originality and talent are still very rare things. So even though you have people who desperately want to make a movie and who now realize you can make a movie very cheaply, that still doesn't translate into either inspiration on the one hand or into an understanding of the craft. I mean, what's interesting is when you watch the French films, even the ones that are extremely minor, they're all really well lit. You know, every shot makes sense. The scripts are always worked out. The performances are always good. And in virtually every case, every film I name, you can't name the film that it's copying. Whereas, you know, when a lot of the American independents that are clogging our theaters now, you know, are like ninth generation attempts to be Quentin Tarantino. You know, even as Quentin Tarantino is trying to stop being Quentin Tarantino, you still have people making movies that are trying to somehow piggyback on the success of Pulp Fiction, or they're trying to resurrect film noir ideas that have essentially been dead since 1955. Or you have kind of cute gay comedies, you know, that neither straight nor gay people want to see because they're just copies of cute gay comedies that seemed hip maybe 4 or 5 years ago.
There aren't any big action films or Hollywood blockbuster type films on your 10 best list. Were there any of those that you particularly liked during the year, and how come none of them made it to the hallowed top 10?
Yes. Well, actually, probably, you know, the two Hollywood blockbusters that I enjoyed the most were Titanic, which is an enjoyable picture, and it really is a spectacle. Uh-huh. And I think, you know, virtually everyone will see it because you want to see that ship go down, and it's cool when the ship goes down. And actually, I really enjoyed Men in Black, part of the charm of which, I think, was that it didn't overstay its welcome. It was about 90 minutes long. It was a deliberately modest blockbuster. But as for like a lot of the kind of bombastic pictures like Con Air, I just, they're not good films to begin with. And I think even the audience doesn't like them so much anymore. You know, I mean, I think that it's interesting that, you know, the rise of the sort of return of the big success of the horror film, I think probably is some sort of response to that. I mean, you know, the big Christmas movie to date has been Scream 2. You know, a copy of, you know, basically a sequel to last year's big Christmas movie, Scream, which is a horror movie that's highly self-conscious about horror movies.
My guest is Fresh Air's film critic, John Powers. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Fresh Air film critic John Powers. We're talking about the best movies of 1997. Were there any big disappointments for you this year? Films you were really looking forward to, but greatly disappointed you?
What's strange is I think I no longer have hopes. That sounds negative, but I think that over the last few years, Hollywood films have been so incredibly disappointing that I now go in and am pleasantly surprised if something is good. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, I mean, last year was, you know, was the, or excuse me, 1996 was the first year when basically Hollywood couldn't even pretend they'd made any good movies. You know, they couldn't find anything to nominate for Oscars. Whereas this year, if you look at what Hollywood has brought out, there really are lots of really interesting and good films. L.A. Confidential is an interesting and good film. Boogie Nights is an interesting and good film. Kundun is an interesting and good film. And, you know, even things like Titanic, which aren't great films, are good, solid Hollywood filmmaking. You know, so, but in advance, I don't really get excited anymore because it's always a surprise when things turn out to be good.
Steven Spielberg's Amistad was supposed to be one of the big prestige movies of the year. You know, great movie, great subject, you know, major themes. What do you actually think of the movie?
Well, actually, I think it's a great subject, you know, a really interesting story, and the film doesn't quite live up to it. I think it's actually a very honorable film, but it has that kind of slightly weighted down feeling of something that is trying to be so important that it's actually not a very interesting piece of filmmaking. What I find actually most interesting about Amistad is to pair it off or to compare it to Jackie Brown, because you get a sense of like how the different ways that maybe powerful white filmmakers and white people, you know, more or less relate to the African-American experience. When Spielberg, you know, makes films about black people, they're nearly always oppressed. It's about slavery and horror. And in a case like Amistad, it's a triumphant story for the slaves. Nevertheless, he's viewing them as these historical victims, and they're seen very much from the outside. The camera work is extraordinarily worshipful. There is something. I mean, I've said that there's something of Robert Mapplethorpe in the way that Spielberg's camera shoots the African slaves in Amistad, and you can tell that he actually really thinks of them as these kind of noble figures, but they're largely physical figures, extraordinarily beautiful and muscular, and the camera loves the rippling of their bodies. And it's an admiring way, but it's a very distant way. In contrast, a film like Jackie Brown is made by a young guy who wasn't raised middle class and who clearly wants to be a black guy. You know, Quentin Tarantino, you know, talks in dialect sometimes. You know, the people who work with him will say, yeah, he wishes he could be black. And you can actually see that in Jackie Brown, where the two major characters played by Pam Grier and Sam Jackson are black characters. I mean, Quentin Tarantino may be the only important American filmmaker who's made two huge movies in a row where the major character is black and there's no point being made about that. That Tarantino is so interested in, envious of, and identifies himself so profoundly with these characters that he actually makes films about black characters, yet it's not part of the film that they're black. I mean, that's an incidental feature to the plot. Whereas when someone like Steven Spielberg will make a film about black people, that is always what the film is about.
What do you think were some of the best performances of 1997?
Yes. Well, actually, the performances in 1997 were very strong for men and very weak for women. It's probably more interesting even to start with the weakness of the women because, you know, I know lots of critics and was, you know, have been involved in various critics groups that have been voting. And what's strange is that women's performances were so weak this year that it was almost impossible for anybody to find anything to give an award to. You know, when it came time to name Best Actress at the LA Film Critics, the votes were all over the map because there was nothing that seemed like a major performance.
Was the problem with finding good performances by women this year a problem with the actresses' performances or just with the insubstantial roles being written for women?
Yes. Well, I think that the annual problem is that there aren't very many good roles for women. For whatever reason, and I mean, obviously, you know, some sort of sexism is the major overriding reason, that Hollywood has a really hard time finding roles for women. I think there's the perception that women and women's films can't really open and have a big opening weekend. There aren't any women stars who can really deliver the box office in the way that men can. And the way this translates itself into scripts is that more and more films tend to have women in kind of subsidiary roles. And so in a case like this year, I can barely name movies that are about women. There's My Best Friend's Wedding with Julia Roberts and Cameron Diaz, but that's not really an award-winning kind of turn that Julia Roberts gives. There's Contact with Jodie Foster, but she's been better a lot of other times. You know, there really aren't films where women are at the center. And so that to start with, you just have far fewer performances to deal with. And then I think it's kind of a down year in general. You know, some of the performances that I thought that were rather good, like Jessica Lange and Michelle Pfeiffer in 1,000 Acres, you know, wouldn't have a chance to win awards simply because the film wasn't good and wasn't popular. So you have a very strange year where someone like Julie Christie in the Alan Rudolph film Afterglow may well get an Oscar nomination simply because the field is weak, and therefore her really wonderful performance in a very small film shines all the more brightly. Whereas, you know, in other years, if you had lots of big star roles in Hollywood movies, you know, she might not get a deserved nomination because people would think that her movie wasn't big enough.
Were there any actors new to you this year who you really enjoyed in movies and are looking forward to seeing more of? Not even necessarily young unknown actors. I'm thinking even of Philip Baker Hall from Boogie Nights, who was also in Paul Thomas Anderson's previous film, Hard Eight. He's wonderful. I'd love to see him in more movies.
Yes, no, I think both Philip Baker Hall and the guy who plays his protege in Hard Eight, John C. Reilly, are two really wonderful actors who, in all the ado surrounding Boogie Nights, kind of got lost. Philip Baker Hall's performance in Hard Eight as this kind of wise old gambler Sidney is one of the two or three best performances of the year. It's a really wonderful performance. And John C. Reilly was both his protege in that film and Mark Wahlberg's sidekick in Boogie Nights. And he's really, really funny and alive in both of the films. They're really terrific performances. You know, in Riley's case, he's had the disadvantage of being a supporting actor in a film that has the Burt Reynolds performance that's won all the awards. But really, John C. Reilly is every bit as good as Burt Reynolds. It's just not the kind of performance that's sort of warm and heartening as the Reynolds performance is. And Reilly wasn't famous before. And as we all know in these cases, when it comes to awards time, it really helps to have been famous before, because people partly want to have you at the awards ceremony, and they feel safer in voting for you, you know, or they just know who you are, so they've paid attention to you. So probably a lot of people who see someone like Philip Baker Hall or John C. Reilly will sort of vaguely know who they are, but won't vote for them because they're not really sure who they are.
You know, who I think gave one of the more entertaining performances of the year is John Travolta in Face Off.
Yes, I think actually, you know, Face Off was actually a performance movie. I think what's peculiar about it is that although it was an action movie, what was really good about it was watching the kind of acting contest between Travolta and Nick Cage.
Yeah.
And Travolta is wonderfully funny in that movie. In fact, he actually had a pretty good year. You know, he wasn't so good in Mad City, but he was the only good performance in the film She's So Lovely as well. I mean, we're basically, although Sean Penn won the Cannes Film Festival acting, Travolta basically is so much better than him that it isn't even funny. And in Face Off, it's this kind of bravura Hollywood movie star turn. And I think right now, maybe of all the actors in Hollywood, he's the one who actually knows how to, like, give his performances that real Hollywood sheen. You know, it's just like he is so confident. When he steps on screen, you know he's a star, and he's enjoying having a star. There's some of that quality that Cary Grant used to have, where it's just that he knew he was the man and therefore was having a great time doing it.
My guest is Fresh Air's film critic, John Powers. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Back with Fresh Air film critic John Powers. Often the big Hollywood movies of one year try to cash in on the successes of the last 2 or 3 years before that. You know, so basically the studios are trying to figure out what was a success and how can they do it again. Can you see that reflected in 1997's movies?
Well, you can a little bit, although I think what's strange is that there's often maybe a two-year lag. So that there, you know, there are a couple films this year that were they were trying to bill as this year's The English Patient. So there was Wings of the Dove, which was partly being billed that way because it was a period romance brought out by Miramax. And then there's a little film called Oscar and Lucinda that's being brought out by Fox Searchlight, based on a Peter Carey novel, which even has Ralph Fiennes as the lead romantic figure. And it also is a period piece of the kind that can be sort of viewed as The English Patient. But I think we really won't be seeing the fake English Patients or the fake Boogie Nights for probably another year or so. There's a slightly longer lag than you'd think.
Well, how would you say the balance played out this year between independent filmmakers and big studio films?
Yes. Well, I think last year Hollywood had one of the worst years artistically in its history. It might have been the worst collection of films ever. So, in fact, Hollywood bounced back this year. You know, the Titanic's a good, solid entertainment. Films like Jackie Brown is really a Hollywood movie. It's a very enjoyable movie.
Men in Black.
Men in Black, L.A. Confidential, Boogie Nights. You know, there were some really enjoyable Hollywood movies. Face Off is a really enjoyable Hollywood movie. In contrast, American indies had kind of a bad year. The Field at Sundance wasn't very good. And increasingly you find people who see lots of movies saying, boy, there are a lot of rotten American independent movies out there. You know, there are a limited number of screens for alternative films, be they American independents or foreign films. And these days, far too many of those screens are being filled with Tarantino knockoffs or dim little comedies on a faintly sexual theme or, you know, some sort of highly moral story, you know, telling you something that you already knew, like you shouldn't be a racist or, you know, you shouldn't beat up homosexuals on the street or something like that.
Any other themes you see emerging from 1997's movies?
Patterns. I think one of the things that I think is interesting is that we're now at a period where the idea of who's a star is getting more and more complicated. So that we sort of know who the big stars are, people like Demi Moore and all the rest. But these days, stars are often in movies that aren't very interesting. So that, you know, although Demi Moore had, you know, G.I. Jane and there's lots of publicity, or Jessica Lange and Michelle Pfeiffer had Thousand Acres, a lot of the really most enjoyable performances were by women who aren't nearly as famous. So, for instance, there's a young actress named Hope Davis who was in The Day Tripper. She's in a film that's out now called Guy. She was actually very funny in The Myth of Fingerprints. Or there's Julianne Moore, who's really wonderful in Boogie Nights, and she's also really wonderful in The Myth of Fingerprints. She may be our best working actress right now. Or there's Judy Davis, who's never really quite been a star, but who's basically funny in every movie you put her in. I mean, in the new Woody Allen movie, she has, you know, perhaps the great comic scene of the year when she's initially chortling with delight when she hears that somebody's being cheated on, and then discovers, you know, then melts when she discovers that she too is being cheated on. I mean, you actually have lots of people like that who aren't quite stars, but who are doing the most interesting work. I mean, you know, this year, a lot of the best performances that I saw were by people like Russell Crowe in L.A. Confidential or Guy Pearce in L.A. Confidential. They're the two young cops. Or Mark Wahlberg in Boogie Nights. You know, or even someone like Ben Affleck in Chasing Amy, who's kind of a newcomer. You have a lot of people who are starting to emerge. And you have that kind of top tier of stars like Bruce Willis, who I think basically don't make interesting movies anymore. Then you have like the next tier, and they often do make interesting movies. I mean, someone like Sam Jackson is almost always fun to watch, and or someone like Dustin Hoffman. Now that he's a bit less of a star than he used to be, he's actually doing more interesting work again.
Sometimes really interesting movies open and close really quickly, so you don't get to see them, or very few people get to see them on a big screen. But then, of course, they come out a little later on video. Are there any movies from 1997 that didn't play long in the theaters that you'd like to suggest we rent when they come out on video because they were good but overlooked?
Yes. Well, I think probably you know, one of the best little movies this year is Paul Thomas Anderson's Hard Eight, which was a story of a gambler and his protege with a really nice performance by Gwyneth Paltrow that became completely overshadowed because Paul Thomas Anderson made Boogie Nights that came out later the same year. But it's a nice little movie. There's a film by Victor Nunez called Uli's Gold, which won Peter Fonda the Best Actor Award of the New York Film Critics, which is a really lovely, smart, intelligent movie of the kind that is almost certain to get killed in the summer box office, and essentially that's what happened. Like, those are two off the top of my head I can think of.
Good, okay. Any films you're particularly looking forward to in 98?
Yes, I think the film I'm looking forward to most in 1998 is a film called The Velvet Goldmine, which is about glam rock and is being made by Todd Haynes, whose last film was Safe. And who I think may be one of the handful of geniuses making movies in American movies right now. I mean, he's a young guy. He doesn't get to make movies very often. He made a brilliant little film as his debut about the Carpenters called Superstar, which was done with Barbie dolls, and is one of the best movies of the 80s. He then won Sundance with a gay film called Poison, which I didn't like all that much. Then he made the very daring film Safe, which many people found cold and distant. I think his new film, Velvet Goldmine, is going to be really terrific. It's the film I'm most looking forward to.
Well, John, thanks a lot for talking with us about the movies of 1997, and I wish you a very happy 1998.
Anyway, Happy New Year.
John Powers is film critic for Fresh Air and Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our 10 Best Show is produced by Phyllis Myers with Alan Tu and Kathy Wolf. Dorothy Farabia is our administrative assistant. Roberta Schurach directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a recording by Lee Wiley, used on the soundtrack of L.A. Confidential.
About money, I'm not the girl who cared about fortunes and such. Never cared much. Oh, look at me now. I never knew a rhinestone for rubies. I never knew a mink from a sable or seal. Ponies from Reed. Oh, look at Reed now. Got a new man. What a man. He's no handsome Merrill Flynn. I like his face and his bank is Chase. $500,000 ain't tin. Long for a cottage. So I'm the girl who's got an estate with a gate. I'm doing great. Oh, look at me now.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, Pam Grier, the star of Quentin Tarantino's new film Jackie Brown. We'll also hear from Elmore Leonard, who wrote the novel the movie's based on. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.